Welcome to the podcast of Lancaster Brethren in Christ Church, located in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. LBIC is a community being transformed by the love of Jesus, sharing this love with all people. We want this podcast to be an extension of our community and a connection with familiar voices. Together, we want to think about how to follow Jesus in our particular moment. So enjoy the podcast. We're grateful to have you join us as a part of the LBIC family.
Having to control the end result, but trusting that to God. Some of you might be like I was for a season in my life, and I had this, I'm going to use wonky again, wonky relationship with this idea of God's, with God's judgment. Because of the way that I experienced the communication of God's judgment, so I think personally, and I hope what you receive this morning is that God's judgment is good and it's necessary, but sometimes the communication of God's judgment and the way that God judges comes across very differently. And so, not to bash the church at large, but sometimes it comes across incredibly harsh. And God's judgment isn't really associated with harshness as much as it is truth. And so there was a period where I shied away from God's judgment, dealing with God's judgment. There was also a period, both Ruby and I, funny enough, in college, we were like part of the hellfire and brimstone folks. We left those ways behind us a long time ago, but I could tell you a really funny and awful story about one time when we dual preached. She had one night, I had the other, and those kids were crying at the end. They're probably also in therapy for that moment. Now, so I don't really preach like that anymore, although you can call me on it if I ever do. But Chris Green, in his book, Sanctifying Interpretation, says this about the judgment of God, which I think is very helpful and very balanced. He says, and it's in your bulletin too if you want to just refer back to it. He says, if we trust wrongly in our own judgments, we shall be only self-righteous. But if we refuse to make any judgments at all, and this is kind of where I fell into at one period of time because I didn't want to judge and be self-righteous, therefore I refused to make any judgments. But he says, if we refuse to make any judgments at all out of fear of self-righteousness, then we will never participate with Christ in bringing about justice in his Father's world. And so there's this balance and this chord to strike about how to bring about, how to seek God's judgment and God's justice. And so one of the reasons I think we can continue to work for good is because of God's judgment. We trust in the judgment of God. We commit our work, whatever that work is, to the judgment of God. And the good news always is that the judgment of God looks, sounds, and acts like the person of Jesus. It's not just some arbitrary God that we make up that looks like a judge in a courtroom in an American system or anything like that. The judge and the judgments that will be rendered are rendered by Jesus, which is good news. Psalm 82 says this. It is a psalm desiring God's judgments, which in and of itself is interesting. The psalmist is desiring God's judgment. Let's look at verse 1 and then just kind of go through. The psalmist begins, God presides in the great assembly. He renders judgment among the gods. So the image given to us by the psalmist is that of a heavenly court. In the heavenly court, God presides over this assembly. So in an American courtroom kind of setting, God sits in the judgment seat and everybody else is in subordination to him. So when the psalmist is using this imagery of gods, it's not that there are literal gods competing in this courtroom for the main seat. Everything and everyone is in subordination to God and who God is. There is no equal to God. But the person, and I just mentioned this before, the person that sits on this seat is none other than Jesus himself. Jesus says this about himself in John 5:22. The Father judges no one, but has entrusted all judgment to the Son, that all may honor the Son just as they honor the Father. So whatever judgment takes place and whatever judgment will take place will align with the character, with the nature of Jesus that is revealed in the scriptures, particularly in the gospels. And I don't know if it's helpful for you, but understanding this and picturing this, picturing Jesus as the judge, is actually very helpful to me in understanding the nature of God's judgment. I think of a couple scenes in the scriptures. I think about in Gethsemane when the crowd comes, the soldiers come and ask for Jesus, and are you the Messiah? And Jesus simply says, I am. And those words carry such authority that people just fall back. It's not like he gets his fists up and pushes them around or anything, but his voice has such authority that they tremble at the sound of his voice. There's other passages within the Gospels that talk about the authority. He teaches as one that has authority. There is substance, there is strength to his words. There's a passage in the book of Revelation that has been misused by a lot of folks who want to render God's judgment as violent, where it talks about this sword coming out of Jesus' mouth, right? The sword is simply, and Hebrews refers to this, right, is this sword of his speech. Because God, in his creation, what's he do? He gets his hands dirty, kind of, but he speaks. Right? There is power in Jesus' words. So it's not like Jesus is romping around with a sword in his mouth just chopping up his enemies. No, he's simply speaking the truth. And as Hebrews says, that truth is like the word of Jesus cuts through joint and marrow, bone. It splits things. It determines and helps discern what is true. And so you bring all these things together, and when we understand the nature of judgment through the lens of Jesus, we know that God is not after punishment, so to speak, but God is after truth. And for those who pursue what is untrue, they will view and receive and can receive God's judgment as punishment, because what they've been pursuing all along has been untrue. But for those of us who try to and continue to try to align our ways with Jesus, there's nothing to fear, as 1 John tells us. There's nothing to fear about judgment because we're aligning ourselves with the ways of Jesus. And so the judgment of the fact that Jesus is on the throne, the fact that Jesus is the one who is judging, I think, is good news for those who want to live true. The psalmist says that Jesus is sitting on, that God is sitting on the throne in the midst of the gods. There's not this pantheon of gods. How we can think about this term gods is like the Ephesians 6 kind of way that we talked about the term gods when we talked about spiritual warfare, I think, a year or two ago. And so when we understand principalities and powers through the Ephesians 6 kind of thing, we understand this term gods. And what we understood there, what we talked about there, was that these systems and structures in the world are created by you and I, by human beings, and they're endued with certain power that these systems then exercise and organize. Governments are formed by people. And the power that is given to those governments are given and shaped by those who lead them and those who are part of them. But not only governments, but that goes down to the family too. Our family systems can be principalities and powers, and how we organize them either align with the truth of Jesus or they propagate a different kind of power. And so for us as followers of Jesus, what we want to continue to do with our principalities and powers, they don't necessarily have to be evil, right? But a lot of most of the worldly ones are. What we want to do is the principalities and powers that we're a part of, whether it be family systems or church organizations we're a part of or work cultures that we're a part of. We want those principalities and powers to honor God. But these ones that are in the court of God in this psalm are ones that are not honoring God. They're ones that are not honoring God. And so God asks, it's an indicting question in verses 2 through 4, how long will you defend the unjust and show partiality to the wicked? Defend the weakness, the weak and the fatherless. Uphold the cause of the poor and the oppressed. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them out of the hand of the wicked. Now, what I think is important for us to notice here about the basis of God's judgment is that God's judgment is based on the treatment of the weak and the fatherless and the poor and the oppressed. By and large, one of the reasons that the principalities and powers of this world are judged to be wicked is that they attack the weak and the fatherless and the poor and the oppressed. If the wicked live ignorant of the plight of the weak and the powerless and the poor and the oppressed, then God's people our call is to live with an attentiveness to their situation. And not just an attentiveness to their situation, but in fact, allowing our lives to be shaped by the situation of the weak and the powerless and the poor and the oppressed. Historically in the church, and you read this in the prophets, you read this in the historical books, when the people of God have forgotten these groups of people, when their eyes have went up and have looked towards how to be powerful, how to secure themselves, when they took their eyes off of this group of oppressed people, this is when they've gotten off. This is when they forgot God. But we remember God, and actually the weak, the poor, the powerless, the orphan, the widows, these folks draw us into the heart of God. There's a number of ways that we could think about how commit ourselves to the weak, the fatherless, the poor, and the oppressed, but here's just one very simple thing I want to give us this morning. One of the ways that we as God's people can live justly is by doing so with attentiveness for those who find themselves in these places. In other words, the way that we live, the choices that we make, the way that we talk about others or to others, our aspirations, our goals, the things that we pursue, all of those things are influenced not by this up and to the right, not by what we can get for ourselves, but are influenced by the people who are poor and oppressed and the fatherless and the weak. And so we go about with the mobility, that whatever mobility kind that we have in our life, we don't do that freely. We do that with these people in our hearts and our minds. And it calls us to a different kind of life. That's not the life of the American dream. It's not the life of more and more in excess. But it's a tempered life. It's a simple life. It's a life that is attentive to the causes of these folks. Psalmist continues on and gives us a bit of a dose of humility. He writes, "The gods know nothing. They understand nothing. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. I said, you're gods. You're all sons of the Most High. But you'll die like mortals. You will fall like every other ruler." It's funny, when we look out and we continue to do good as God's people, and my wife works in social services. I know there's a lot of teachers, and they're, I mean, the systems that we face in the world are hard, right? And it's hard to continue to work for the good when it feels like the systems that you're a part of are just working against you the whole time. But the psalmist is really clear here too. Like the folks who impose these things on the poor and the fatherless and the weak, they're walking around in the dark. Like they think they know, but they don't know. And they continue to operate out of this ignorance. But the psalmist says, woe to you, or Jesus says later on, woe to you who think they are blind, but they can see. All the gods, all the powerful people who run the systems and the structures, who have power, friends, are mortal. And it may seem like these folks are untouchable. It may seem like the systems are unchangeable. I mean, we look on global scales, it looks like the militaries that they have at their disposal are immense. We continue to see that. We see the powerful have wealth that keep them isolated, but they are still all mortal. There will come a time when their time ends, and that's not to be morbid in any sort of way. Every Ash Wednesday, we proclaim this over ourselves. From dust we have come, and to dust we return. It helps us when we consider our mortality to have a posture of humility. If we don't consider, or when we don't consider our mortality, we become those gods maybe that the Psalms are talking about. But when we consider our mortality, that we're given a short time when it comes down to it, within the course of our lives, and we have opportunity. We have opportunity to join Jesus in the work of his kingdom in doing good in the world and seeking the good of the world. It gives us a humble posture that this thing is not about us. This life is not about us. This life is not about just about you. It's not about your little bubble. But the question is, what are you doing within the context of the world to join Jesus in the good work that Jesus is doing? And it's a call to discernment, too. How are we getting embedded in these systems that oppress other people? In fact, when we think of our goals and young people, as you think about the goals that you have for your lives, as you enter into college, as you graduate, as you get married, wherever stages you're in, or if you're a young and married couple, like the point, when you think about the goals that you have for your life, allow them to be shaped by the weak and the fatherless and the poor and the widow. Not just all the things that you can attain and that you can do, because there will come a time when you find that they're empty. They might be nice for a season, but they're empty and they don't have staying power. You always crave more for them. But when you give yourselves to the good, when you give yourselves to the work of the kingdom of God, there's a substance to that that is just wholeheartedly different. So it's a good reminder, too, for us in our lives. The judgment of God is a really good reminder for us in our lives to live for what is true, to live for what will last. And so the psalmist ends with this prayer for God to rise up and judge. God's people actually desire God's judgment because it's only God who can make things right in the end. You and I can't ensure that our efforts in doing what is good and right and Christ-like will succeed, but that doesn't mean that we stop doing them. That doesn't mean that we give up. When we do that, we join the gods, so to speak, as the ones who attack the weak and the fatherless. We create the poverty. We oppress others. But the psalmist invites us to pray with the activity not only of our lips but our life. Rise up, O God, and judge the earth, for all the nations are your inheritance. Friends, the judgment of God isn't something to be feared. And if you have that perspective of judgment, read 1 John 4, like, a lot. The judgment of God is not something to fear. One of the things, I think it's good for us to rethink what that looks like, because we do have this very punitive, at least, I don't know, in the back of my head, there's this punitive, punishing image of God. You know, when everything's said and done, God's just going to kick tail and take names, and all of us who are, you know, all of us who are saved are just going to fly away, oh glory, and everybody else is going to gnash their teeth and all that kind of stuff. I don't think that's quite the imagery of Jesus on the throne. I think the imagery of Jesus on the throne is... And I'll just use myself for an example. I don't have, at least in this point in my life, I don't feel like I have to fear that. But Jesus is going to speak truthfully to me. Nolt, you did well here. Here, these are some ways, and Joshua, before you enter the kingdom of heaven in its fullness, you need to know that these areas of your heart and your life were off. Some by a little, some by a lot. And I need to speak truthfully to you, because the kingdom that you're going to enter is one of truth, one that is defined by me, defined by Jesus himself. And so that judgment of God, for those of us who want it, is going to be a good thing, because I think many of us want to live true, right? Like, part of being transformed into the image of God is to be made like Christ, who is the truest of the true. And so when God renders a judgment for us, it is for our good. And when God gives judgment to others, it's also for their good. I go back to 1 John because he talks about, if you're afraid of judgment, it means you've not been perfected in love. If you're afraid of judgment, you've not been perfected in love. Because it is the ultimate reality, not of punishment, because fear has to do with punishment. The ultimate judgment on us and all humanity is going to be the fierce love of God in Jesus Christ. Love is going to be the judge. And I think we can welcome that. Rube, I'll invite you, wherever you are, hopefully still here. Yay! Everybody say hi, Ruby. Ready to go hellfire and brimstone? No? Okay. That's good, because I'm not either. So I had, Christian, I'm going to switch to this microphone here, if I could. Check. There we go. You want to sit?
Hi.
Long time no see. Sorry, this morning. We had coffee. So I gave her a series of questions, and so I'm going to ask you with the microphone, and then you answer, and then when you're done, just tilt it my way so I can, you know. Got it?
Got it.
Last week, we all sung happy birthday to her, and she loved me for it. And this week, I asked her to speak, and she loves me still. So this is, what, 22 years?
Maybe
not next week. Well, it's okay. All right. So here's the first question for you. And again, framing this, how do you continue to do good in the midst of just really difficult places? But exactly what do you do, and what does that mean, whatever it is that you do?
Social work is the big overarching answer, but I am a permanency supervisor with children and youth. However, I get to be employed by Kobe's Family Services, so it's kind of a weird partnership. Kobe's is known for adoption and foster care, but they also contract with Lancaster County Children and Youth as two permanency units within the agency. So we are responsible for children who are in placement. They've been removed from their parents because of abuse or neglect at some level. We're responsible to work with the parent on their child permanency plan that is approved by the court to help reunify or find a permanent plan for the child. So our primary goal is looking out for the parent to alleviate the reasons that brought the child into care, but also the children to find permanency, safety, and well-being.
So in your work, what are the wrongs that you hope would be righted, or what is the good that you work for in the midst of all that?
So he asked me this question, and I've been mulling it over quite a bit, and I've said to my workers many times, there's a verse in the Bible, there's a story about Jesus healing a man, and at the end it says that he was dressed and in his right mind. And then he went and he told people, and they didn't recognize him because he wasn't dressed before and he wasn't in his right mind. And so I feel like our job is to see them in that place of where they're not in their right mind and they're not well, and give them respect and value and dignity and see them as a person and not as a problem. See them as a story and value that story and hear their story directly from them. We're in a place of power because we know their story. We know their wrongs. We have a piece of paper and many notes with years and years maybe of history of the abuse and neglect and unwell of their family, and they don't know anything about us. So I challenge my workers to reverse that and imagine that they're sitting there and that person knows their story, right? So valuing them and helping them to go from this place where they're at when we meet them to a place where they're dressed and in their right mind.
I know over the last, I don't know, you're in the midst of a difficult season in what you've done. You've been with Kobe's 5 or so years. And this is probably one of the more difficult seasons that you've been in. But how do you continue to work for the good? How do you continue to do what you do when it seems like maybe things aren't working, or you're facing things that are bigger than you that seem to be against you? How do you continue on?
I would say the first answer is I've been doing it for 20 years, so I have a really tough skin. But that's really not the answer. I think the reason or the way we do that is there's two things. We speak truth because that's the only thing that will help set people free, even if it's hard to hear. I think encouraging my workers to speak truth even when it's difficult, they gain value and respect from the client, but also their own self because they're speaking that truth, and they can't debate that, especially in the court, because the court is what is making things a lot more difficult these days. You can only speak the truth that you know to be right and true, and telling your client that this is what I'm going to be speaking on your behalf, whether it's going to be hard for you to hear me say it in front of you to the court or not, valuing them enough to do it prior and letting them know what's happening. But then on the other side of it is, I tell, you had said it earlier, like, it's not about you. None of their behaviors, words, fears, anxieties are about my worker. My worker is just in a place that is holding them accountable to their wrong. And so helping my workers and developing them enough to be able to say, okay, they're yelling at me right now, but their anger is not about me. It is about something deeper, and I'm here to listen and to help make them whole. And so it's constantly me redirecting my workers to say, stick to your script, know what you have to say, but listen to them and know it's not about you.
Can I ask you one that's not on the...
No.
No? Okay.
Yeah, it's fine.
Well, I guess one of the things that I... And I don't know if this is as much a question. Maybe you can talk about it a little more. And you did mention it earlier. One of the things that I really respect about Rube and what she does and how she leads in this space is she continues to demand dignity where probably the majority of folks looking on a story or a situation would not demand dignity for a person and would blame. What causes you to demand that dignity and to work for that dignity in people?
I mean, I think every person has value, and I think if you believe that, that's how you talk to a person. And I think that's how I would want someone to hear my story on the other side of it. And I feel like if I don't, who will? There's a lot of families who generationally have been in the system for a really long time, and my worker or myself might be the very first person who heard them and gave them a place to be a person, and that's why it's important. And I mean, that's how, because that's the mindset I'm going in with, and that's what I want my workers to do. And so if you see them as a person and instead of just the thing, then you have to.
Back to the script, last question. How do you encourage your workers, or how would you encourage us to continue to work for the good when it doesn't seem like the wrong ever stops?
This is a sports analogy. So anyone know baseball? You know how in baseball you like go to a game, it's like 9 innings, and it's really quiet and boring sometimes, but then there's a home run, and everybody's like crazy, and then you're like waiting for the home run to happen again. I feel like I tell my workers a lot, it's not a home run today, it's base hit, or we got walked, you know, something like that, right? Like baseball home runs are exciting when they're a home run or a grand slam, because it doesn't happen all the time. And people keep going because they're like, last time this happened, I hope it happens again. I feel like with the cases and the families that we're serving, it's not always going to be that. It's not going to be that high, big grand slam. It might just be a strikeout, but we do it every day because we're hoping for that home run or grand slam, and that's what keeps us coming back.
I think she deserves a hand just because she used a sports analogy.
Thanks for being there.
I'm pretty sure I've never used a sports analogy up here. So that's impressive. And that's also one of the other things I love about my wife is that she loves sports. Oh, so good. Well, friends, we're going to prepare for to receive communion here this morning. For those of you who might be visiting us or might be here for the first time, this is an open table, and so any of you who desire to receive what Jesus offers to you at this table are welcome to receive. Rube, I'm going to play off of the last thing that you said. I feel like Jesus does the same thing with us too, right? So this table continues to be set before us, whether you've struck out, whether you've walked, whether you've hit a grand slam, whatever it may be, this table continues to be set before us. Jesus continues to give himself to us fully. And so in a moment, we're going to receive communion. I think the worship team is going to lead us in a song before that. But I just encourage you, as they lead us, as we sing together, let's just sit with this, that Jesus has prepared this table before us again because his posture towards us is one that desires for the truth and the life of who he is to continue to dwell in us and transform us. Jesus continues to give himself to us. So let's participate, worship, and sing together, and then we'll receive together.